This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Secretary of Defense Esper and Secretary of State Pompeo both sent a joint letter to the Egyptian president to say, look, this is a big mistake, and, you know, the friendship you may have with the president can't overturn this, so it's going to be problematic for Egypt if they go ahead.
That's David DeRoche, Associate Professor at National Defense University, on the possibility of sanctions on Egypt. Details coming up. Also, a U.S. State Department report says there is growing concern that thousands of Islamic State-linked fighters are carrying out deadly attacks in Mali, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, and other countries. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A top story, the World Food Organization warns the humanitarian crisis in Africa's Sahel region is growing, while the world pays scant attention to this unfolding tragedy. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Conflict and hunger are leading to sharp levels of displacement in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger as people flee their homes in search of safety and something to eat. The UN World Food Programme reports more than 860,000 people are internally displaced across the three Sahelian countries, while they are hosting more than 270,000 refugees from other countries. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says 20 million people living in conflict-affected areas are bearing the brunt of this looming hunger and malnutrition crisis.
The conflict is devastating for agriculture and for rural economies, and almost one in three children is out of school in many conflict-affected areas in those three countries. This year, more than 2.4 million people require urgent food and nutrition assistance in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger.
Burkina Faso is the worst-hit country in the region. WFP country director David Bullman says malnutrition rates among displaced people in some areas are 19.7%. He says the UN considers 15% to be an emergency level. On a phone line from Rome, he tells VOA climate change is making the population more vulnerable. He says Burkina Faso only has one rainy season from May to September in which farmers can plant and grow their crops.
And with the climate evolution, that rainy season has become a little bit shorter. Fortunately, this last rainy season was quite good, so the overall crop is good. But in the areas of insecurity, people haven't been able to carry on their farming as normal. That's been disrupted, and a lot of them had to abandon their crops in the field as they were displaced.
WFP reports that escalating fighting in the central Sahel also is limiting humanitarian access to families in need. The agency currently is providing food aid to more than 2.6 million people, but it is running out of cash at a time when emergency needs are increasing. WFP says it urgently needs more than $150 million to continue its life-saving activities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Amid international concerns that Islamist fighters are expanding their influence in the Sahel region, another attack on Mali's military has left 24 soldiers dead and 29 wounded. Mali's military says 17 extremists were also killed and 100 captured in Tabankort in the northern eastern Gao region. It said the extremists attacked a joint operation by troops from Mali and Niger near their border. About 100 Malian soldiers were killed in two other recent attacks in an area that the jihadists once held until they were forced out by a French-led military intervention in 2012. The State Department's annual report on extremism says the region south of the Sahara Desert is of growing concern, with thousands of Islamic State-linked fighters carrying out deadly attacks in Mali, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, and other countries. French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said yesterday that all West African states need to help tackle jihadist groups in the area. Delegations of women in Cameroon are visiting towns and villages to encourage women to run for office in February's local and parliamentary elections. Women make up less than a third of Cameroon's 180 lawmakers and just 6% of the 380 mayors. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé on prejudices keeping many women out of politics.
Members of the activist group More Women in Politics tried to convince 62-year-old Dieudonné Kemche to allow one of his six wives to run as candidate for the local council election. Kemche, a member of Cameroon's polygamous Bamileke ethnic group, says he is not sure his wife would perform her household duties if she became an elected official. He says his wives cannot be wasting time by taking part in political activity. They are supposed to be busy taking care of their children, says Kemche, working on the farm and at home, cooking for their family and being respectful to their husband. Kemche's wife, Stephanie Ngono, a primary school teacher, disagrees and says despite her husband's resistance, she is committed to run for office. She says men should stop the attitude of restricting their wives' liberties and freedoms. They should understand that women join politics for their own emancipation, says Ngono, and to give to their communities just as they contribute to the progress of their families. Ngono's defiance of her husband to participate in politics is rare in patriarchal Cameroon. Traditional gender roles are still dominant in most areas and most women are economically dependent on their husbands. Coordinator of More Women in Politics, Justine Difo, says men usually make the family decisions and do not allow their wives to be seen in public with other men, impairing their participation in politics.
Nous avons mis en place une chaîne de solidarité féminine pour appeler les femmes en général et tous les.
She says they have mobilized support for women, not only to take part at the local and parliamentary elections by voting, but most importantly, by being candidates themselves. They are visiting all the council areas where the February 9, 2020 elections will be conducted, says Difor, to make sure female candidates will not be rejected for not meeting legal requirements. Cameroon's political parties say they are working to increase the number of women to run for elected office. Secretary General of the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, Jean Kwete, says after hearing complaints from women, they are making changes.
La promotion des femmes est un engagement fort. Pour être concret,
the party has decided that 4 out of every 10 candidates for the parliamentary elections should be women, he says, and that at least 42% of those vying for elective position in local councils should be women. But even with the growing participation of female candidates, getting Cameroonians to vote more women into office in patriarchal societies remains a challenge. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
After Egypt signed a $2 billion deal to buy more than 20 Russian fighter jets, Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs Clark Cooper said it puts Cairo at risk of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has, over the years, provided Egypt billions of dollars in economic and military aid. David Roche, Associate Professor at the National Defense University, explains why to VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi.
Because there's a law called CATSA, which requires the president to impose specific sanctions on countries that engage in certain transactions with Russia involving intelligence, advanced military technology, pipelines. It was passed over the president's objection in 2017, but it is law of the land. So it's not just Assistant Secretary Cooper. Secretary of Defense Esper and Secretary of State Pompeo both sent a joint letter to the Egyptian president to say, look, this is a big mistake, and, you know, the friendship you may have with the president can't overturn this. So it's going to be problematic for Egypt if they go ahead.
But President Trump has stopped short of imposing sanctions on Turkey following the deal to buy S-400 air defense systems.
That's true, and part of that is because the congressional mood towards Turkey, which is a member of NATO, which doesn't receive any financial assistance from the United States, is very different towards Egypt. Congress has always been a bit concerned about human rights, about the LCC's seizure of power, things of that nature, and the fact that Egypt gets $1.3 billion a year. Congress looks at that and says, why should that be so? So even if Trump is able to hold off imposing sanctions, there's still a significant chance that Congress will cut the military assistance to Egypt. So Egypt will suffer either way.
Is there any compromise that could be reached with Egypt, which gets $1 billion or more in military assistance from the U.S.?
Well, honestly, I don't know for the life of me why Egypt wants to add a third sort of advanced fighter. So they already have the F-16, which is American, which has American equipment. And, you know, if you're going to train in it, you've got to learn to speak English. They've got the Rafale, 36 of those, which is French equipment. Now you've got an officer corps that has to learn French, and they want to add a Russian thing to the mix. The maintenance structure of the Egyptian Air Force is challenged to maintain, provide spare parts for the aircraft they have. You know, if you have three, I mean, you have to have different sets of tools for all these aircrafts. This is a foolish effort just on military grounds before you even consider the possibility of sanctions. And when you look at the security threats that Egypt's face, they're not threats that are dealt with by supersonic fighter aircraft. The threat is an insurgency. The weapons to counter it are low tech, but they require competent small unit leadership, and that's really where Egypt should be investing.
But the Egyptian President Sisi insists on diversification of Egyptian army weaponry.
Egypt has so many challenges, and Egypt is a very poor country that, you know, they've got subsidies, they need infrastructure, they need education, and to build a redundant fighter capacity which is not really responsive to any threat they have and which is going to cripple their bureaucracy because now they have to have three training streams for officers, three spare parts. It's just a foolish move. When you throw sanctions and the risk of a possible cut in military assistance, it really is almost criminal for any Egyptian leader to contemplate this.
So do you know of any response from the Egyptian government to the U.S. warning?
I haven't heard of anything. You know, typically, you know, a country in this situation would invoke their sovereignty, but you can invoke your sovereignty while enhancing your security capability. If Egypt decides to make this an issue of their national sovereignty, they'll find that their ability to defend their nation is going to be damaged even before sanctions are imposed.
That was David DeRoche, Associate Professor at the National Defense University, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The top U.S. diplomat in Africa says President Donald Trump's administration is seeking $4.9 billion for Africa operations, including a focus on security in the Sahel, fighting disease, and enhancing commerce. Tibor Nash, the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, at this hour is testifying before the U.S. House of Representatives Subcommittee on Africa about the budget request for the 2020 fiscal year. Cheryl Anderson, the Deputy Assistant of the U.S. Agency for International Development for Africa, is testifying alongside Nash. She said the U.S. continues its Ebola vaccine program, patients tracing, and community engagement. Under the theme, Leaving No One Behind, the World Health Organization is marking today's World Toilet Day by calling for policy reforms and measures to improve the work environment for sanitation workers. A new report shows that millions in the developing world are forced to work in conditions that endanger their health and lives and violate their dignity and human rights. Mavis Ochera in Washington has more.
The report on sanitation workers in 9 developing countries is jointly authored by WHO, the International Labour Organization, WaterAid, and the World Bank. It aims to raise awareness of the dehumanizing working conditions, the critical role that sanitation plays in reducing disease and creating healthier communities, and expanding sanitation access to the more than 4.2 billion people living without safely manage options. In Africa, the report focuses on Senegal, Kenya, Burkina Faso, and South Africa. Sanitation workers clean toilets, empty pits, and septic tanks, clean sewages and manholes, and operate pumping stations and treatment plants. WHO sanitation and water team leader Kate Medley-Cott says although sanitation workers provide an essential public service, they are often the poorest and most marginalized and discriminated against members of society. She says sanitation work is often informal, with workers getting no rights or social protections. Pay can be inconsistent or non-existent, as workers report being paid in food rather than money.
It's quite saddening and sickening in some cases just to see these circumstances, but it does vary. What we see is sanitation workers in very informal employment with very low pay, low job, low security, doing manual emptying in some cases with very little protective equipment and facing a whole range of health and well-being consequences from that. Worst cases, that would be death from inhalation of toxic fumes or pit collapses. They face injuries from sharp objects, microbial infections from exposure to excreta like that, in some cases drug and alcohol abuse to kind of deal with the disgusting nature of the work.
Medley-Cott says as various governments strive to achieve sustainable development goals, including access to adequate and equitable sanitation and hygiene for all, and an open defecation, emphasis must be placed on safely managed services where sanitation workers are on the front line.
We know that poor sanitation is responsible for over 400,000 deaths from diarrhea every year through transmission of diseases like cholera, dysentery, typhoid, and hepatitis A. And what we see in the data of countries' national targets for the SDGs, they're hugely ambitious, which is really encouraging, but it also challenges us to think about the workforce that's going to be delivering these services, especially because in many countries we're seeing increased urbanization. So those, the need for sewage services or emptying of septic tanks and latrines. So those workers at all stages of the sanitation chain are really critical to achieving those goals.
Medley-Cott says the WHO would help strengthen national capacities, focusing on ensuring protections of sanitation workers are included in national policies and risk assessment and management at a local level. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Ochery in Washington.
Zimbabwe's government is pursuing flexibility in turning its wildlife into a sustainable resource, saying the populations of elephants and other animals have grown so much that they are endangering humans and can safely be culled in limited numbers by hunters and for ivory. The argument, which has been proposed several times recently, also reflects efforts to ease the country's worsening economic crisis and deal with a devastating drought that has killed at least 200 elephants and led to proposals to relocate thousands of animals. Kodzanai Musengi attended the annual African Wildlife Conservation Forum this past week in Zimbabwe's resort town of Victoria Falls and filed the following report.
Ngwabizita Ndlovu, Zimbabwe's Environment, Climate Change and Tourism Minister, told the meeting he's worried that the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, seems to be influenced by non-state actors and is no longer respecting the principles of sovereignty and equitable and sustainable development. He told VOA that Zimbabwe believes in the role that CITES has to play and that, along with other southern African countries like Botswana, will continue to lobby it to change its stance on elephants.
We believe in CITES. We believe in the important role it potentially plays. Animal rights activists have been given prominence over the last couple of years, and we strongly believe a lot of what they are saying is not consistent with the policies of those countries. So we want to make sure that as governments, we come together and we come up with a common position. We will not allow animal rights activists to hijack CITES.
Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia and Zambia say the increasing population of elephants in particular is causing many problems, including deaths from elephant-human conflict and destruction of natural habitat. But animal rights activists at home and abroad have been blocking efforts by the southern African countries to reduce the numbers of the big mammals. Lenin Chisaira of Advocates for Earth, an animal rights group in Zimbabwe, says he's concerned that the official statistics of the elephant population in the country may be exaggerated.
There's need for, you know, a transparent population count so that we can ascertain whether they've overpopulated or not. Because at the moment, the figures are one-sided and they may be used to save energy.
Danine van der Veste is an CEO of Operators and Professional Hunting Associations of Africa, says there is ample scientific evidence that elephant numbers in southern Africa have risen to unsustainable levels. She slams activists for being sentimental.
They blatantly refuse. They do not open up the ears. They've got a stance and that's it. And those are people that have no vested interest in our land. And we are selling our souls, unfortunately. And it's high time that Africa start to realize the exceptional high value that we have in our own resources and that that is what the world actually seeks.
Zimbabwe once threatened to pull out of CITES, but Minister Ndlovu says it will continue lobbying for change while pursuing other alternatives like declaring a reservation, which would enable the country to sell its elephants to other state parties. Lied Amberlin, joint CEO of the US-based Safari Club International and Safari Club Foundation, says CITES should allow communities in African countries with high numbers of elephants to determine how to control them.
CITES has positioned themselves with regard to the elephant from an ivory standpoint, whereas they're not looking at the communities and the damages that they're doing to crops, the damages that they're doing to villages as a whole, including completely wiping out entire villages and the homes associated with those.
Safari Club International represents the interests of hunters, but is also involved in wildlife conservation. Hamelin told VOA that his organization is lobbying against the pending Cecil Act that would prohibit imports of lion trophies into the U.S., saying it would hurt African economies. Reporting for VOA from Victoria Falls, I am Kudzanai Msengi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the fall of the Berlin Wall 30 years ago marked the end of the Cold War and brought about a number of significant changes in Africa. We'll take a closer look on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Straight Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.